Doing Hebrew texts, we're going to be looking at something really quite tremendous. Last week, as a reminder, we used Hebrew essentially to really grasp a pivotal verse. According to a lot of the online Bibles, it is the second most looked up verse in the Bible, the Jeremiah one that we looked up. John 3:16, beating it, as it were, to that title. However, tonight, we're going to look at the text that I'm going to suggest is possibly the most important one in the Bible. We'll see if you agree by the end. Jesus did, but it's up to you if you want to disagree with us. it is, of course, the Shema in Deuteronomy when Jesus was asked what's the key, as it were, to the whole thing, the greatest commandment. He, of course, replies with the Shema, and there was a good reason for that. But however we look at it, it is certainly intrinsic, it is foundational to everything that we're supposed to be. And so it is my hope that, like last week, we are going to just focus down on one verse. I'll talk about the context a wee bit, but we're going to really focus on this one verse. Love the Lord your God with ... and hopefully get an awful lot out of it. So some weeks are quite expansive. We know, like at the opening, we looked at lots of titles of God. It was quite a wide-ranging thing. But again, tonight, just like last week, we're going to focus on one verse in particular. And hopefully by the time you leave, you'll actually be really encouraged to realize how much more there is in that verse than what we would normally read out of it. So before we go any further, let's pray. Gracious Heavenly Father, we do indeed come before you just now, expectant, waiting indeed to learn to hear, to understand more essentially about you and who we are supposed to be before you. So I pray, Lord, that you would bless us in our endeavours tonight and that we would indeed see something of you. In Jesus' wonderful name, amen. So, let me start here. I've heard this analogy many, many times, particularly when I was a child growing up, I heard this. People used to tell me that the Old Testament is like the foundations of a house, and the New Testament is the house that it's built on those foundations. It's a good analogy, it's a decent analogy, but I'm a biased Old Testament person, so therefore it wasn't quite sufficient for me to go with that analogy. And instead, I actually say something like this. The foundations are the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, because everything else is built on there. So the narrative and the law at the outset leads to the prophets and the writings and the history. You know, when you read the Psalms, it's reading the law and then trying to work out how that impacts with real life. You know, I mean, when you look at the prophets, it's about the people not living up to this and the consequences of that. You know, it's all built on the Torah. So I'd say the foundations are the first five books of the Bible, the Torah. The house is the Old Testament then. The roof, the walls, I suppose the flooring, doors, windows, all that kind of thing. Which then, of course, leads me to say, well, what is the New Testament? If the Old Testament is the house, what is the New Testament? And I'd say that the New Testament is essentially the soft furnishings. It's the carpet, it's the wallpaper, etc. Now, that may sound slightly disparaging at the outset, but allow me, please, to continue. you see, the New Testament, say like the Gospels, imagine like a carpet, you know, they are lying on the floorboards, they're lying on what is there. Every single verse in the New Testament is utterly dependent on what has gone before. And when we do not realize that, when we don't see what lies underneath the carpet, as it were, we don't really get what's going on. But the key thing for me in terms of Old and New Testament and the house analogy is that the difference is, you know, the New Testament takes what would be an empty shell and turns it into a home. It turns it into somewhere you would want to live. And although it all hangs on the shell that was there, you know, it is a place where life could be. And I think for me that is a better analogy to understand. Plus because you see the interdependent relationship of the two much better. But it also brings to the fore the importance of the first five books. The first five books tell you all about creation. They tell you about sin. They tell you about why we wear clothes. They tell you about marriage. They tell you that everything actually that is intrinsic to human beings and their relationship with God starts there. All of the history that comes after it is even known as Deuteronomistic history, which I can't say quickly five times. It is history based on the worldview presented to us in Deuteronomy. You know, what makes a bad king? Well, look at Deuteronomy. it all hinges on these texts. And so my analogy then is, as I said, the New Testament is all of these sort of things that make the home, the light, as it were, that illuminates what is inside there. But it all hangs on the Old Testament, and the Old Testament itself hangs on the Torah, the first five books. So, to push my analogy, if there had to be that initial excavation, if there had to be something which was that first piece of the puzzle, as it were, what would it be? What would be that initial piece, the foundational text, essentially, to the whole building? And it would be my contention that that text would be the one we're going to look at tonight in Deuteronomy 6. So, as I said, the Old Testament is the house, the New Testament makes it a home. That's the big difference. Now, and that's just playing with an analogy which could have survived quite well, let alone when we get to the text. You know, when we're looking at these things, when we're looking at it, I mean, I always come from a slightly different point of view. When I became a Christian, I was 10 years old. I hadn't met any Christians that I was aware of, which I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. I still don't know. But I was on an island. I was incredibly bored. It was a howling gale outside. Couldn't go outside. I had read every other book on the island, and so I read a Bible. it was the only one left to me. And I mean, I was unbelievably bored. I was out of my tree with boredom, and I picked up this Bible. And what happened was, like, God did something. And what's unusual is that if you pick up a Bible and you don't know any Christians, you would treat it like a book. You would start at the beginning. You'd read from Genesis. You don't get told, actually, you want to start near the end. You start with Genesis. And from that moment on, everything kind of went in that direction. And I think there's an awful lot that we can get when we do see things from that direction, as it were, flowing, as it were, towards Revelation and beyond. So, the Shema. Deuteronomy 6:5 in particular is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might, in Deuteronomy 6:5. It is widely recognized as being the most important part of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. This is what we're going to really focus on today. Jesus obviously cites it in Matthew and Mark and Luke in the contemporaneous accounts, citing it to sum up the whole of the Torah, this foundation, as it were, to sum it all up in one go. He turns to this text. Now, when Jesus is asked what's the most important text, he doesn't just choose this one on a whim. He doesn't just think, that's a good one. This text was already at the center point of the religion of the people. Now, this was the text that everybody already used. He's turning around and saying, you see that text that you said this morning? You see that text that you say every night? You see that text that actually is already playing a significant role in the religion of the society? Yeah, that's the one. it's not like he's everyone's thinking, I wonder what that text is, and looking it up. They knew it. This is the first text that was to be memorized by a Hebrew child. It's the very first text that was supposed to be whispered into the ear of a newborn child. It's the text that gets written out into scrolls and affixed onto doorways or to actually be worn by the wearer. This is the pivotal text to being a Hebrew. And so when he's asked, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus replies with the one that they already treat as the greatest commandment of them all. I've had three children, and on each occasion, I would take the newborn child, and the very first thing that they would hear would be my voice, reaching in, as it were, and telling them the Shema. So it's quite easy to the first two children, because they've got Hebrew names anyway, but it'd be, Shema Yitzchak, Yahweh Elchinu Yahweh Echad. And we'd start off and we'd tell them the Shema. Now, it's not because I believe that they're magic words, and you say them over the baby and it's going to make, sort of cosmic difference. The point of it, actually, as a parent, sitting there with my newborn, my firstborn, you think about this. Here he is, he's born. We'd waited 12 years to have children. We'd been told on many occasions we couldn't have children. And suddenly I'm now holding this newborn baby. The opportunity for my life to treat him as some sort of idol was huge. The point of saying these words to the baby is because at that most precious moment in my life, God is to be at the center. Who, you know, this child does not even belong to me. This child belongs to God. I loaned this child to raise, but this child belongs to God. And at that pivotal moment in his life and in my life, these words are to be uttered. You know? Shema Yitzchak. Listen, Isaac. This is what matters. And so that's why it took a pivotal role in the society. It was this greatly significant verse already, as it were. And so this is why we're going to be focusing on it tonight, because I still believe that if you want to sum up the first five books of the Bible, this is where you start. If you actually want to sum up what it means to be one of the people of God, this is where you go. If you want to understand, you know, the skeleton, as it were, in which you build your life on, I think that this is where we start. You're free to disagree. We'll have an interesting conversation afterwards. But it's certainly pivotal. It's certainly foundational. It's certainly key to everything that we're supposed to be. And so I thought, well, if we're going to do some Hebrew words, we should focus on this text. That's the idea, anyway, tonight. So it starts off in the verse prior, in verse 4, it says, listen. So, Shema, listen. That's what we have in the opening verse, best understood as hearing, but it's not. That's not quite enough. When you say, you know, listen, so-and-so, it can imply that once the person has finished speaking, that's the job done. So you will have maybe finished listening to me when I finally take breath at the end, as it were. But the Shema is different. To Shema something, first of all, you value the speaker, so you are going to listen. You value the message, so you're going to imbibe this. Indeed, you are so much listening that you take it with you when you leave. To Shema is to begin a process. And so very often, Shema is translated as obey. But actually, that's kind of at the end of the process. The actual process is value the speaker to such a degree that you take in what he is saying. And you make it part of your life. And then, yes, you will go and you will do something with these words. And so, you know, if you're translating it, you kind of think, well, what do you do? Well, we'll go for obey. And you think, well, okay, that kind of gets you to the end of the process. Obey. But the downside to that is you might obey because you're scared. You might obey because you feel obliged. You know, it's not got that same impetus of valuing the speaker to such a degree that you will listen on every word that he has got to say and you will make it a part of your life. Obey doesn't quite convey that. But if you have to choose one word, it's a pretty good one. Shema. It's the first word. Shema Yisrael. Listen, Israel. Listen, imbibe, take it in. This is God speaking. You're going to want to listen to what he's going to say because he's about to tell you something that is going to shape your life. So listen. That's just the aperitif. That's not even getting to our proper words yet. That's just the aperitif, as it were, before we get into the main verse, in verse 4. Listen. And what's really beautiful is that he says, listen, Israel, Yahweh, you know the personal name of God? This is not God far away. This is God in relationship. So it says, the one you're in relationship with, listen to me. But it says, Yahweh Elohimu, so your Elohim. So listen to your God of gods. And this is the outset. This is what we have at the beginning. So to say, Shema comes from the word to hear, as it were, but it is leading to action. It's a hearing and doing, as it were. And it doesn't just stop once the message has stopped being spoken. You're to listen, as I said, because you value the speaker. And you demonstrate that value in what you then do. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God, Yahweh is one, is where we start. So that's where the word Shema comes from. It comes from there, Shema, hear. And this text, this wider text from verse 4 onwards is known as the Shema, the prayer that would be offered up on a regular basis. Every day supposed to be offered up and supposed to be memorized as soon as possible. the Shema, the centerpiece of the Hebrew religion. So the foundation of what it means to be the people of God, this is really quite important. It doesn't really hinge on just simply doing enough things. If you go for obey, you know, obey me, you know, obey my commandments, as it were, you can have that impression of if you just do the checklist, a good enough checklist, you're good with God. And this verse, it very intentionally turns that on its head and says, no, it's not about that, it's about love. It's about valuing God to such a degree that you would Shema. And the whole point of it is to turn it on its head. Being one of the people of God is not about keeping the rules. As Jesus says, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. No, if you keep my commandments, I might love you. You know, it's a terrible way around to do it. And so from the very beginning, there's this idea that love comes first, valuing God comes first, leading to action. So, these are the words we have, this foundation. Let's see. Yeah, I quite like verse 6. So what I've done is I've mentioned verse 4, Shema, you know, listen, O Israel. We're going to be focusing on verse 5. That's where we're going to spend most of our night. Let me just point out what happens just immediately afterwards as well, though, to show you the context of this verse. In verse 6, it says, and these words I command, literally it says, these words which I trust you with, which I think has a different flavor than necessarily command. I think command has a certain feel to it. Literally it says, you know, these words that I trust you with, which to me actually raises the level, as it were. It kind of adds to the pressure, as it were. You know, if I'm commanded to do something, that's one thing. But if I'm actually trusted with something, that's a whole other level, you know. And the reason that you can see that these words shall be in or on your heart. I mean, it's quite clear where this is pointing towards. It's not really pointing towards your obedience. It's pointing towards something much more profound long before that comes into play, as it were. And these words that I command or entrust you today shall be on your heart. So the words that we're going to be focusing on are to be entrusted into your heart. So you've got Shema at the beginning, which tells you about that process of valuing God and listening to God and doing. Immediately afterwards, it says, I'm trusting you with these words. You know, you've been told to listen and do these words. I'm now entrusting you with these words. They're going to be in your heart. And of course, as we continue, I love what follows. We've got sort of Hebraic hyperbole here, which is just absolutely amazing to give over the idea. Here's the text from 7 to 9 that follows the Shema. And you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. These words are to be everywhere, as it were. So what happens is all of this underscores verse 5, you know, the entrusting, as it were. And at the outset, you see this idea of, you know, this is supposed to be taught to your children. This is a multi-generational truth. This goes on, as it were, forever. This truth, it doesn't have an expiry date on it. It's supposed to be taught to each of the generations. And what's interesting, if I just push it back a second, you know, when you talk of them, when you sit in your house, walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise, all of that is a very common Hebraic poetic style whereby they posit two extremes like this. If I ascend to the heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. So the two extremes. Morning and evening. Evening and morning and at noon, I utter my complaint and moan and he hears my voice. And so you get these two extremes, the morning and evening, the heavens, Sheol. What he's trying to say is not just in heaven and Sheol. He's trying to say from the top to the bottom and everything in between. So by saying, you know, from the east to the west, he's trying to say from that point all the way through to that point, including everything that is in between. So when it says in our main text, when you lie down and when you rise, he's not just simply saying, when you go to bed, remember the words of the Shema. When you get up in the morning, remember the words of the Shema. What he's saying is, yeah, when you get up in the morning, remember those words, and you're going to take those words with you every single second until you get to bed. It's that kind of Hebraic extreme, as it were, the two extremes to say everything in between as well. These words are not just for your morning and your evening, they are for everything that comes in between. So like the heights and the depths type of thing. When we look at that text, we see we've got every generation, whether you're in the comfort of your home or whether you're outside of the home, so everywhere you can go. When you're in bed and when you get up, so the end and the beginning of the day and everything in between, on your hand, so that's everything that you do, before your eyes, so it actually means all of your thoughts before your eyes, in front of your mind, as it were, every single thought that you have. The entrance of your homes and the entrance of your gates, which actually adds a public decoration, a declaration to the words, as it were. It's a private reminder every time you enter or leave your home. So it's not just when you leave, just before you leave the home, remember the Shema. It's take that with you, and when you come back. You know. So it's trying to show you just how important these words are. They are supposed to be everywhere in every thought and every deed at all times. That's what that means. And for all generations. Again, it kind of underlines, emphasizes the importance of the text we're going to look at. If this is how it talks about it, that shows you just how important this is. It also explains why we have this practice of Medusa, where Jewish people will actually write out this text onto a scroll and will wear it on their persons, or will nail it on their door. I mean, this is the reason why that occurs. It's not meant to be literally, you know, wear the text. It's a little bit more important than that, because you could wear the text and not live by it, as it were. It's a bit more important than just simply, you know, an accessory. It's supposed to be how you govern your life. And so there's an equivalent in Exodus 13. So Pharaoh, he refuses to let the people go, and so there's the Passover, and so God says, you know, as they are leaving in Exodus 13, verse 16, that it will be forever before their eyes. It will be like a frontlet and before their eyes. And he's not trying to say, you now have to wear their blood on your face. He's saying this will be always there as a reminder, and then the Passover meal is this annual event all the way through to remind them of what happens. It's not supposed to be taken as literally as wear the blood, and equally this is not supposed to be wear the text. It's bigger than that. It's be this text. It's imbibe this text. It's Shema this text, and then go and do it. If you see what I mean. And that's the context for the verse that I wanted to look at tonight. Now, does that make sense? I've kind of rattled through that because there's an awful lot of what I want to really speak about on the verse. But does that make sense, what I've been going on about, as it were, with the context? Good. Yes, the direction that the religion takes after AD 90 with the destruction of Jerusalem, particularly in the Western Jewish context, is essentially to elevate the law and to try and fulfill every single component of the law, minus the temple, minus, you know, the physical, other physical things that they could do. And yes, much like Christianity for a very long time, goes the same way. It elevates the to-do list, you know, this checklist, as it were. And we fail to understand the law. I mean, the book like Leviticus, for example, Leviticus 19, it was a wonderful list. And as Christians for a very long time, we've said, oh, well, you know, do this, cover that up, don't do that, you know, that kind of thing. And that's not what the text is all about at all. Instead, it reveals the nature of God. God cares about this, and he cares about this. So if that's how God feels, do you feel the same way? That's how it was intended, and I can say that because of what I said at the beginning of the chapter. It's a pretty big clue that that's how you're supposed to interpret it. But we, as Christians and the Jews as well, we have, maybe it's human nature to want to love these laws, these rules, rather than actually have to love the lawgiver. Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. It asks a lot less of us. You know, if you think of a law such as the field laws, you know, like keeping the edges of the field for those who are in need of it, you know, most of us can say, well, I don't have a field. And actually, those of us who do have a field, we employ a lawyer who comes in and says, it's just a really large garden with wheat. That's what we do with laws. We kind of work around them, you know. Tax avoidance of God's law. But that's not the point. The point is that God says, this is how I feel. Do you feel the same way? Do you actually have a concern for these people? Do you actually go out of your way to ensure that these people who have nothing are actually included in the people of God? You know? And the checklist is easy. But actually, shamaying God, listening to him, imbibing him, and living that out, it's costly. And it's a big deal. It asks a lot of you. Yeah. Not as much as you actually receive, but it asks a lot. Because it asks for all of you. Which is the point of this text. Let me move on then to... that's kind of what I was saying. To some of the translations. Now, last week when we looked at some of the translations, I think some of us were quite surprised at the variance, actually the disagreement that there was amongst the verses. Now, tonight is slightly different. This text is so pivotal, so integral, that it is largely translated the same across the board. So you don't get the same red flag kind of moment, as it were. So let me just show you a few. Good News and NIV are exactly the same, with love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your strength. ESV or New King James, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your might. So a very slight difference between strength and might. The Message, which actually, it's a shame this has been recorded, but this may be the first time in my life, possibly the last, The Message gets this really good. This is a remarkably good translation, actually, and is actually maybe better than the others. I'm not entirely sure why I'm so uncomfortable saying that. It's maybe just a natural reaction, you know. But it is actually spot on when it says, love God, your God, with your whole heart. Love him with all that is in you. Love him with all that you've got. But that actually hits the nail much more firmly on the head. Though it doesn't pretend to be a translation as such, that actually hits the nail right on the head to a greater degree. And we're going to be unpacking it to see why I would say such a thing. These are some of the translations. And you'll notice they're largely the same, apart from the fact that we might change strength and might a little bit. Heart and soul, they're stuck with that. They are in there. We're not changing them anytime soon. It's interesting, actually, the Orthodox Jewish Bible, which is in English, but every now and again, if there's a word, like one of the names of God, that it just cannot put into English, that it feels, it would just be wrong to put it into English. It will keep a sort of a Hebraic a side to it. And it has like a complete breakdown when it comes to this verse. So it starts off, and you shall love, and it just breaks down completely. That's it. That's the end of the English, as it were. Because every single word in the rest of the text is so big, it doesn't fit into English. I love that. That a translation that is essentially that halfway house just breaks down completely when it comes to this verse. And that tells us something. That tells us there's actually an awful lot behind this verse in the Hebrew that an opportunity like this evening is well suited to bring out. Of course, what it actually says is this. Shema Yisrael, Yahweh Elohinu, Yahweh Echad, V'chavta Ith, Yahweh Elohika, Bika, Levavka, Uvkal Nefeshka, Uvkal Modeka, V'heyu Hadavarim Ha'eleh, Asher Anoki, Misavka, Hayom Al Liva Vivka. And you go, well, of course it does. Now, there's a reason I've just done that. And it's not just simply so I can read some Hebrew out, although, I mean, I'm not going to pass up the opportunity. The point of me just doing that is actually to say the Bible wasn't written like that. The Bible and the Hebrew Bible was written like that. That's what it actually says. And what it says there is quite different to what we have. I think what we have is a remarkably good translation, because, as I said, you know, it's like that word obey, when actually Shema means an awful lot more. But what other word would you use? You know, you have to put a translation out there. You don't get to stand next to the book for an hour explaining every word like I do. You've got to put one word down. In actual fact, the translation is remarkably good. But just now, well, we get to really look at this. And I have to say, that is what it says. And that is different, as you'll see, hopefully, with the rest of our time tonight. Hebrew is a beautiful thing. It conveys more than English, I think. I think for tonight, our four words that we're going to really focus on are the word Ahev, which is used for love. We're going to look at Levav, which is used for heart. We're going to look at Nefesh, which is used for soul. And we're going to look at Meod, which is used for might. I think they're pretty much the key words in the verse. We're going to look at what these words mean in their fullness. And hopefully by the end, you will be able to come up with a better translation. That's the challenge for this evening. Hopefully, having listened to me, or maybe even Shemad, what I'm going to be saying, that you yourself will be able to see a better translation by the end of it. So we'll see. So let me start then with our first word of the evening. It does say 29 up there. It certainly shouldn't. It should say word 11. I think it does in your handout, to be fair. I think the thing that you actually take away with you is accurate. That's quite good. Word 11, Ahev, sometimes it's Aheb, which means love. Now, I have to say at the outset, there are many Hebrew words for love. I'm going to focus on one of these words, but there are plenty of other words for love. Chesed, which is this unbreakable love of God, literally, the love that will not let me go. So it literally means. If you see it as loving kindness, just say, no, I'm not accepting that. A kindness is a response. So God loves you in response. This is the love that inspires creation. This is the love that saw Jesus heading towards the cross before I was born. It's not loving kindness. It is the foundation to our existence and our future. It is the love that will not let me go. That's what Hesed is. We could have used dod. Dod is another word for love. It's a brilliant word. It means to overflow. actually, you can imagine a love like that, can't you? You love to such an extent, it just kind of overflows. In the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, it's most often used for love amongst very young people. First love, that initial burst of love, as it were, that is just kind of overflowing. Oddly enough, it's also used to describe the love you might have for an uncle. Now, I'll explain that. I think it bears explaining. The idea of the love you have for an uncle is because that's the leftover of the love you have for your father. That's the linguistic thought process behind it. You love your father so much it overflows to even loving his brother. Hence how the same word is used, as it were. And so you could have dod, for example. That's a great word for love. But here it is, Aheb. Aheb is different. Aheb is used to describe the most profound loves that you will ever experience or even imagine. Aheb is used 212 times. If you use the feminine version, Aheba, you've got another 36 uses of it, so it's quite a common word. But it is used to describe the most profound loves in your life. So here we go. What does Aheb mean? Well, it's used to describe the love of parents for children, which is, at least in theory and very often in practice, the greatest love, as it were, to love your child. It's used throughout the text. I mean, Genesis 22:2 talks about Abraham's Ahebbing for Isaac. Now, Isaac's no longer a child as such, but he's still his child. This is the child of promise. And this is at the point that Abraham believes that he's going to have to sacrifice his son. Now, Abraham has already sacrificed his past for God, and it looks as if he's going to have to sacrifice his future. And it is in that context, it is said, that he loves his son. Acheb, the most profound love that you can have. So that's in Genesis 22, verse 2. His precious son. It's also there for Isaac and Rebekah, which is supposed to be the greatest example of love that we have in the Bible. It's the archetype of love. It's where we get many of the Jewish marriage ceremonial elements. It's from their love. It is seen to be one of the greatest loves of all time. Acheb. It's the love of Jacob for Joseph over all of his brothers. He achebs him rather than the others. It's the love that Isaac and Rebekah have for Esau and Jacob in Genesis 25, verse 28. It's this profound love for your child. So that's one way that it can be used. Another way it can be used would be the love for a spouse. And I think that this would be the most common use of the term. It's the most frequently used example. That desperate love, that unbelievable intertwining together love that you can have for a spouse. So the love for Isaac, for Rebekah in Genesis 24, verse 67. The love for Jacob, for Rachel. You know, so he works for 7 years, but it seems just a day because of the love that he has for her. Which is one of my favorite verses to describe love. The desire of Leah for her husband, Jacob, to love her. So in its absence, it's used. Leah is desperate for her husband to love her. It's in the attitude of Shechem for Dinah. Shechem, who is willing to do anything to get this woman's hand in marriage. It's used very often for this wonderful thing, this intertwining together, this instance of love. And the whole point is that in the Hebrew mindset, and it's very conscious that this is not the experience of all, but is at least what it should be. And I love the Hebrew model of love. The Hebrew model of love is that you meet each other when you're relatively young, and over the years and decades together, you are increasingly becoming one. You know how in Genesis it said, and they shall become one. That's more akin to, and they will forever be becoming one. So I've been married just shy of 20 years to my very patient wife, and I recognize now that journey of always becoming more one with her. I'm more one with her now than I was 10 years ago, or certainly 20 years ago. There's a journey that goes on. And so the Hebrew describes it in Proverbs like this: let your fountain be blessed, which is actually a sexual euphemism. I'll just leave it there. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. A lovely deer, a graceful doe, let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her acheb. It's the most profound love that is being described here in Acheb. What else do we have? Well, actually, you've also got this love between best friends. Because in actual fact, quite often, and for many people, that connection that you can have with another human being in that way can be one of the greatest and most profound loves that you can have in your life. So David and Jonathan are the archetypal example of that, that this incredible bond that they have as friends. And so it's said to be Acheb. The devotion or affection for someone. And so this is an interesting one. Like a servant who is free. He could go off and be anything, anywhere. But he is so devoted to the person that he works for or his master that he refuses to leave. You know, it's this profound bond and dedication, as it were. Of course, it's also what is used when we're told that we have to love our neighbor. You know, when Jesus uses the Shema, he then follows it up with the Leviticus text, love your neighbor as yourself. This profound love. You know, because people, they didn't ask, oh, what do you mean by love, Jesus? They asked, who do you mean by my neighbor? They knew what the love meant. You know, they knew full well what was being referred to when love was there. It's like, you know, they didn't say, when you say love, I mean, you know, what do you mean? No, who do you mean by my neighbor? That's where the debate was to be had. You know? It was very clear what was there. And I love the fact that Isaac uses it to describe his favourite food. So Isaac is speaking to Esau, and he's trying to get Esau out of the tent. He's trying to get him as far away as possible. And he's sending him really far away to go get some venison. We usually translate it as venison. That's probably what he's going for. And Isaac is really over-egging the pudding, as it were, to continue the cooking analogies. And he's going, oh, but I just have venison. Please go get the venison for me. I mean, he's really going over the top, as it were. But the very fact that he uses that word in that way to motivate his son out to go get this meal goes to show you the strength of the word, as it were. So what I've just shown you there is this word in use. I could have just told you Acheb means love, and that would have been accurate, that would have been fine. But do you see how by going through the examples of what it actually is used for, that we actually get a better grasp for this? And when the Hebrews actually have so many words for love, it's good to know what is being talked about here. This is the most profound loves that you can have in your life, the strongest bonds, strongest connections that can be there. And it is that word we just used at the outset. Love. Love the Lord your God. Because, of course, this word has a religious use as well. Because it's this most profound word, God very often takes the very best that we have to offer in our experiences and says, right, I want you to imagine that and apply it to me. You know what a shepherd is? Apply that to me. And you know what a mother is? Apply that to me. You know what a father is? Apply that to me. He does this very often. And so he takes this Acheb, he takes this thing that we have, this incredible bond that I've just shown you, and it gets applied in a religious setting. So, for example, the love that God has for his people. Now, I've already said that he has hesed, which is this unbreakable love. But that's almost unimaginable. That's so vast that it doesn't really mean anything in one level. You know, it's so big. And so he says, I want you to imagine the biggest that you can and apply that to me. The strongest love you can imagine. Apply that to me. That's how I feel about you, is what he's trying to say. And so it's used alongside hesed. That more relatable term of heb is used. That's just a couple of examples on the board. I mean, it is a very common way that God will say, this is how I feel about you. The strongest bond you can imagine, that's what I have for you. And so we have this love of God. And so he's saying, imagine your best. I am your best and more. So, for example, in all their afflictions he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his aheb and in his pity, he redeemed them. He lifted them up and carried them all the days of old. You see what I mean? It's beautiful, this love that God has for his people. And, of course, as a result, it gets used in other ways as well. So, for example, God loves righteousness. He loves justice. You know, he has a strong love for these things. He has the love, then, of the people for God. So it's supposed to be reciprocated, this love that God has. It's supposed to be turned back, as it were. We're supposed to have that connection to God as well, which links us to the Shema. So it's this use here that we have clearly in Deuteronomy 6. But that love for God should be the strongest we can imagine, that strongest bond that we could possibly have. I was discussing today, in actual fact, in one of the classes I was doing today, someone was saying, you know I should love God, but I really love my family. And they saw this as a conflict. And I said, well, actually, no. For me, to be the dad that my children deserve, I need to put God first. I need to love him with everything that is within me. And then I can become the person that they deserve. For my wife, the most precious gift given to me, I have to love God more, the most, absolute, to the nth degree. And the closer I get to him, the more I become the person I'm supposed to be, the better it is for her. And I'll end up loving her more than I possibly could. I know what I'm like. I need to be more like him. That's who she deserves. And I try to explain it like that. And so this love that we have for God is to be paramount above everything else. And so it's there. And of course, as a result, we're supposed to have the love for the Torah. The first five books of the Bible. There's a great passion in the Bible for the Torah. This is a wonderful passion because what does it do? It reveals God. When you read the first five books of the Bible and the rest of it, but particularly here in this context, the first five books, you get a glimpse of God. You see what he feels. You see him coming to the rescue of people. You see him on the side of people. You see him moving. You see him doing things. You see him speaking. You see him giving a law, saying, these are the things I care about. Don't do these things. You get a glimpse to the very heart of God. So how could you not love it? How could you not be passionate about this? Because you're actually seeing God. So it's this great passion. We often translate that as the law of the Lord, but it's more literally the Torah, the entirety of the first five books of the Bible, from Genesis all the way through to Deuteronomy. So that's love. And I wanted to give that breadth to it, because that's our start. That's where we start with this. Love. The greatest love that you can imagine for God. But it continues, love the Lord your God with all of your... Well, we've got levav, which we often translate as heart. So, you've been very good. You've been listening to me intently. Or at least you've looked like it. How do we understand heart? What does it mean when you're told to love God with your heart? Now, I'm going to give you a minute to think about it. You know, questions are going to get harder. But I'm going to just a minute. Talk to the person beside you. Get your thoughts going. Try and think, what do you understand by heart, and what does it mean to love the Lord your God with all of your heart? And I mean it. I'm giving you a minute to try and talk it out. On you go. Okay. Believe me, if I gave you an hour, it probably wouldn't be long enough either. So, what do we think? What do you think? How do you understand heart, and what does it mean when you're told to love the Lord your God with all of your heart?
The whole of your being.
Good. The whole of your being. Yeah? That's a pretty good start already. The whole of your being.
We don't think it means just emotion and passion, but it should include that.
Good, yes. So, I mean, knowing full well that I'm going to say it's bigger than whatever you think, I mean, knowing that's where we're going with this, you're saying, okay, it includes emotion, it includes passion, but it's more. Good answer. Yeah.
Desires.
Good, desires, yep. Good. Yes. Yeah. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to rattle through the ways in which it's used to try and again show you this composite picture, as it were, of what was intended by levav, and then show why we have difficulty and why that Jewish Bible just kind of collapsed, as it were, when it came to this to translate it. So it occurs 251 times, levav, and lev, which occurs 698 times, and they're both usually rendered as heart. And you'll appreciate tonight, I'm not going to go through every single instance, but try and kind of collate them, as it were, in similar groups. So when we think of heart, we normally think of the seat of the emotions, as it were, you know, where our emotions tend to come. Interesting enough, the Hebrews and the Greeks place their emotions in your bowels. Yeah. Now, if you think that's odd, how many of you had butterflies in your stomach? Yeah, for me, it's more like rampaging elephants, I'll be honest. But, you know, that sensation of an emotion in your bowels, as it were.
Does yes. heart not mean more than emotion? It's the center of your being. If your heart doesn't go, you don't go.
Yes, yes. I mean, I'm going to go on to say that whatever we think it is in our Valentine's Day cards and all this kind of stuff, clearly it should be more. I think it's more in English, to be fair, although we normally just reduce it to a very small component. But in Hebrew, it is huge. So we usually associate it with all of the emotions, not just love. I mean, when you see a heart on a card, you normally imagine it to be a positive thing. But actually, within the heart of man, there's a whole array of emotions it could be. That picture could say, I really hate you. From the depth of my heart, I despise you. I mean, that's what the card could mean, but clearly that's not what's intended or received, I hope. But actual fact, I think we recognize, at least within the emotions, that it would include the negative as well as the positive ones. You know, because we can store up hate. We can store up an awful lot of emotions, as it were, inside of our hearts. So this is what we see in Song of Songs. We have this, you have captivated my levav, my heart, my achoth, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. And so we can see that the romantic side of hearts is still there in the Hebrew. It's not as if that's gone. But we should recognize that it usually encompasses an awful lot more. Bear in mind what follows that verse is quite explicitly romantic. Lips and tongues and all manner of different things are included. Those emotions that inspire all that are included in levav. However, we also need to bear in mind that although we have love, we also have hate, fear, pride, greed, and lust. Sorry, grief. Greed is there as well. And lust in this place. So the seat of all the emotions. And it's associated with the heart. And so we could think, well, okay, I can understand why heart is used here in this text. The problem is, of course, that although it does incorporate everything we could imagine in heart, heart does not actually fit with the vast majority of the uses of levav. I think it fits with any of those examples. It doesn't fit with the majority of the uses of levav. This is reflected in some of the modern translations. So some of the modern translations will translate levav as mind very often. So, for example, in Exodus 14, verse 5, when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of the Pharaoh and his servants was changed towards the people, and they said, what is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? Very often, it's the thinking or the mind. Now, to be fair, in English, we have a phrase, to change your heart, as it were, a change of heart. And what we mean by that is not that you're now in a different emotional place, but that you've actually reconsidered what you've done and have come to a different conclusion, essentially. So even within the English, although we reduce it very often, there's still that component of the mind included when we say heart. And this, actually, to be fair, is the most common way. So Ezekiel 38:10 produces a parallel between levav and thoughts. Thus says the Adonai Yahweh, on that day, thoughts will come into your levav, and you will devise an evil scheme. Clearly, this is a place where thoughts as well as emotions resides. So, interestingly, the most common way the levav is used in the Hebrew text is to do with thinking, having an inner monologue with yourself. So, for example, the fool says in his heart there is no God. He's saying it, as it were, with his inner monologue through his mind, I guess. There is considered opinions. Your imagination lives in the levav. All of your planning, all of your studying, all of your learning, it's the place of wisdom, it's the place of knowledge. All of these, and actually these are more common than love or emotions for levav. So the problem with sticking with heart comes through. So for example, make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy and blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts. You see, we're not asking them to make an emotional decision. If you, decide with your heart, that in English means something very different than what is intended very often when that same phraseology might be in our translations. It's actually a very considered thing. It's not just simply an emotional sea change, as it were. And so levav encompasses a huge amount, to be fair. So it can be equated with the mind as well as the heart. Thoughts, plans, wisdom, studying, they take place as well as all the emotions. It's actually also where your memory is stored. And I think now we're really kind of getting quite far away from how we would immediately see heart. You know, your memory, as it were, is stored in your levav. He taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast my words, keep my commandments and live. And clearly, this is your memory that is being included. And when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I've set before you, and you shall call them to mind. Yeah, you can see it's the memory that is included here in levav. You also have this idea of integrity, which is really quite interesting. That's quite good timing, actually. That time. There's this idea of integrity that kind of comes out. So it's the things that lead towards your actions all come from your levav. So being upright, which we have in Kings, we have it in Psalms, with an upright heart, he shepherded them and guided them with his skillful hand. It's that sense of integrity that comes through instead. So simply looking at it, heart doesn't very often convey what was intended in levav. But actually, sticking brain in doesn't work either, because then you do miss out on the emotions. Levav also governs your actions, which is what Christ talks about, you know, how the uncleanliness of the man comes from within, comes from his heart, as it were. Levav is therefore associated with love, hate, lust, panic, fear, courage, intention, study, grief, thinking, wisdom, knowledge, understanding, and learning. It's got all of your emotions, it has all of your intentions, it's got all of your rational thoughts. They're all included in levav. If you are a stubborn person, I'm not looking at anyone in particular, if you are a stubborn person, it's in your levav. And therefore, if you're told to love the Lord God with all of your levav, it means love him stubbornly. You know, it's everything. Everything. So you get all of these different things. And I mean, no wonder they go for heart. I think heart at least conveys a good chunk of these things. Even in English, I think heart does, to some extent, convey quite a lot of this. And I think that's maybe the best that we can do, unless you go slightly odd, like I would, as it were, in this context. And I'm going to stop heart there, because obviously I'm going to come back and I'm going to try and do a whole kind of big reveal, as it were, as to how I would do it. The important thing at the moment is to notice that it actually conveys everything that is intrinsically you. You know, if you were downloaded into another body and you were still you in a different body, you know, that would be your levav having been moved, as it were. It is everything that makes you, you. Yes. That's right. So later on, some of the Greek translators going into it recognize a lot of the difficulties. And so they'll say heart and mind quite often later on to try and encompass it. But he's referring to this commandment, as it were. And that's an attempt to try and bridge the gap. But even then, heart and mind isn't quite enough either. You know, it is everything that makes you, you. Everything. And I think, you know, when we read heart, we lose out on that, to be fair. You know. But purely because we're running out of time, which is always the case when you're trying to do the Shema in one night. soul. Just very quickly, just tell me, what do you think of when you hear the word soul? Don't really know is probably the most common response I get to this question, to be fair. You know, if you're part of the I don't really know category, that is fine. You're actually one of the majority, to be fair. Let me make it harder. What does it mean to love the Lord your God with your soul? Because you're told to do this. This isn't just an abstract thing. This is like, you know, the pivotal foundational text I'm telling you all about. This is something you've got to do all of the time. What does it mean to love him with your soul? Okay, so right down deep, as it were. Your living being. I'm going to get to that, yes. So Saul, I'm afraid, is a bit of a problem. So while Levav, actually, I'm trying to be as kind as I can. Levav, Hart, I get it. I get why they've gone for Hart. I love the opportunity to expand on it, but I get that. Nephesh and Saul is terrible. That is a terrible translation. I understand why, but it's still terrible. The reason that we go for Saul has got nothing to do with the Bible, but has an awful lot to do with the Greek pagan religions. You know, Zeus and Hades in the underworld, you know? And what they believed was that body bad, soul good, essentially. And essentially your body dies, you leave the bad bit behind, your soul gets freed, and you go to the afterlife. And you basically wander around as a soul, as a shade. And you wander around. And different poets and different philosophers have different opinions as to what happened. I quite like Homer's version, where you just kind of wander around until you slowly disappear. It's one of the more positive ones. But that was the Greek pagans. It's nothing to do with God whatsoever. That then gets applied to the Bible. And soul gets applied to the Old Testament. Now, the Hebrew people had no concept of a soul. You know, as in like a bit of you which is separated out and goes on somewhere else without your body. They had no concept of that whatsoever in the Old Testament. Now, I'm saying that. I mean, you may decide, as Christians, we do believe in that. You know, later on you could say, well, this is where we've got to post the Bible. But the Hebrew people did not understand it that way at all. And if you're trying to look at the Old Testament texts and you see the word soul, when it uses nephesh, we have a bit of a problem. Now, let me just skip through it a little bit. It is used a lot, 753 times. That is a lot of times for a word to be used. And it is a fairly significant term in how we understand the afterlife, which is a bit of a problem, because the vast majority of the uses of the term have got nothing to do with the afterlife. So as I was saying, it's got a lot to do with pagan mythology. It was Christianized early on. Augustine spelt wrong, I apologize for that. But Origen, Augustine, and St. Gregory, they adopted these ideas and put them into general thought, as it were, general Christian thought. That's pretty much been transported down through the ages. Calvinism took this within a Catholic setting of, again, separating out body and soul. The dualism is essential in Catholic theology, and it is to some extent in the Westminster Confession of Faith as well. There it is. The bodies of men after death return to dust and see corruption, but their souls, which neither die nor sleep, having an immortal substance, subsistence, immediately return to God who gave them. Now, I have to say there are caveats that follow that soften that to a large degree about a new body so that we're not simply souls wandering around like Greek mythology and some of the early stuff. So we do get a new body. But the Hebrews would say, actually, it's your same body that is renewed, which I think is a wonderful concept. I don't have a part-time redeemer. I believe he redeems all of me. I believe every last piece of me is redeemed. Even what you see is reconstituted, as it were, much like our prototype in Christ. He didn't leave his body behind and get a new one, is essentially what we see. That's the subject of a lot of debate and disagreement, but the Hebrew text is quite clear. Nephesh, and here's the problem, nephesh does not mean soul. So while we might disagree about what happens to us in the afterlife, and whilst we may disagree about, you know, a bit of as it goes on, etc., in some sort of soul, that's not what nephesh means. So even if we disagree on the afterlife, and even if we disagree on do we have a soul, I wish I had time for that one. Nephesh, no matter what we think on that debate, doesn't apply to soul. And this is the problem. This, for me, for Deuteronomy, is the key. This is why this matters. Nephesh literally means breath or life. Nephesh is used substantially through the Old Testament to talk about something which you can see or touch. I don't know about you, but whatever we think of as a soul, it's not something you can see or touch. Well, spirit would be ruach, and that is not applied to human beings. That is something of God. So the spirit is a God thing, as it were. But it is also, the ruach also means breath. as it were. So you could speak with the Spirit, you could have this breath, as it were, but that's not an integral part of being human, as it were. The Greeks will think differently later on. But the Hebrews have a very simple way of looking at it. You've got your levav, which is everything that makes you you, and you have your nefesh. And your nefesh, well, Adam has nefesh breathed into him, and at that point becomes a living nefesh. Not that he has a nefesh deep within him, but that he himself is a nefesh. It's not saying he's become some sort of soul, it's saying he now breathes. He is now alive. In fact, just about every single instance of this word in the first five books of the Bible talks to this idea of breath or blood or flesh. So no matter what we think about soul, that's not it. Nefesh is a physical thing. Let's see. So nefesh, usually flesh and blood, Genesis 9:4 connects it as such. Let me take number 6:6, for example. It talks as a corpse, as a nefesh of the dead. Psalms talk about it in parallel to flesh. Your nefesh is what you're living and breathing. My favorite example, actually, in the law says, when you have wounded the nefesh of an animal, your nefesh is required. Now, we could insist that we're talking about souls. We could say, when you've really hurt the animal's feelings, your life is required of you. Or we could say, when you have injured an animal, you need to replace it, or on your own head be it. That's a more likely translation, to be fair. Nefesh is never really used for soul as we imagine it, or however we imagine it, I should say. Nefesh is always a flesh, blood, breath. Yes, sorry.
I'm just thinking medically here.
Yes.
And it's a tangible thing.
Yes, so a nefesh is something that can be touched. You can hold flesh, you can touch blood, you can feel breath. When Elijah brings the boy back to life, Elijah brings the boy back to life, it is said his nefesh returns to him. And it's this idea that he is once again breathing. And the point is that, I suppose, that if any of these things are not there, your body, your blood, or your breath, you don't have life. And that's kind of where the connection comes in. Each of these leads to life. And if you lost your blood, or if you lost too much blood, or if you lost your breath, your life would cease. And so it is that you are a living thing because you are a nefesh, if that makes sense. So nefesh points to breath, flesh. Throughout Numbers in particular, it points to blood in particular. Can point to a corpse as well, although that's the nefesh of the dead, as it were. And all of these things come together to be life. The big problem is trying to equate that with soul. You know, the big problem is trying to say, how on earth do you get that into that? Because however you understand all of these tangible things, it doesn't really fit with soul. I don't know if that answered. But the point is that each of these things is a tangible thing, a physical thing. Any one of which, if it wasn't there, would mean an end of life. I think my main problem is that soul is an intangible thing. No matter where we stand on it, that's an intangible thing. It's not a thing that we can touch. It's not a thing we see. It's not a thing we feel breathing on us, for example. Nefesh always is. It's always something that's actually right there. As you sit there right now, I can see your nefesh. As it were. If I got close enough to you, I'd be able to feel your nefesh on me. If you were accidentally to be cut, I could see your nefesh, as it were, bleeding out in the room. And that's what nefesh means. So that has implications for Deuteronomy. When it says love the God with your soul, with all of your soul, I sit there thinking, well, how on earth do you do that? I've got no idea how you'd love God with something which is indefined can't be touched and can't be seen, and, you know, or a bit of me that will go on in the future. It's a very difficult thing. But, sorry. Yeah. Just to skip, as it were, to the end a little bit, to kind of clear it all up a wee bit. I sometimes think in computer terms to try and explain this one. So your Lvov, I know, that's not going to help you, but it'll help some people. If you imagine, your Lvov is like your software, and your Nefesh is your hardware. Your Lvov is everything you can't really see, but is essentially what makes you you. But your Nefesh is the bits you can see that can get broken by, you know, falling over. So your Nefesh is what you would be able to see in your body, you're the physical being. And your Lvov is everything that makes you you, your will, your emotions, your you-ness, as it were.
So if that's the case, why did they translate it so in the New Testament? Why is the Greek? Why did they do that?
That's why I don't do Greek. I'm kidding. Yeah, and that's why I kind of had that brief tangent to explain that, look, I know we do soul. It comes in from a place that's not even Christian or even Hebrew. It comes from, you know, Athens, places like that. It's got nothing to do with God, to be blunt. We Christianized it. We Christianized quite a lot of Greek things. I'll bite my tongue at that point because. But we did Christianize quite a lot of things. And one of them was soul, this idea of a soul, that you would exist without your body. Whereas in the Old Testament, it's quite clear. We'll just take the two texts here. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. It's that idea that you wake up later on. And in Isaiah, your dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy, for your dew is a dew of light, and the earth will give birth to the dead. And it's that idea that actually, no, you don't exist without a body. You don't exist without a nefesh. God will have to remake it from the dust of the earth, and you stand before him, as it were, for judgment, actually, is what it goes on to say. Actually, pretty much what it says in later on as well. But that was the idea that the Hebrews had. They didn't see this need to break you down into different pieces. You either love God or you don't. You don't love him with a bit of you, and it's not a bit of you that God saves. It's not like God comes along and says, well, I'm going to save your soul, but the rest of you we're just going to get rid of. That's not how the Hebrews saw it. Job certainly didn't. He says, my eyes, my actual own eyes will see him. And he's not talking in some sort of metaphor. He's genuinely saying, I'm going to see him. You know, not a clever statement. It is what it is. And yes, don't get me wrong, Christianity has taken an awful lot of Greek concepts which I find deeply unhelpful. Such as translating Torah into law, which gives you a whole different interpretation as to what those books are all about. Such as taking away El Shaddai, which is this feminine title for God, and turning it into God Almighty, because the Greeks didn't like the idea of a feminine side to God. We have done a lot of those things. I'm not a fan of, clearly, as a Hebraist. I'm not a big fan of that. But most of the time we actually get by. Right, most of the time we get by these things. It's just part of our heritage. It's part of our culture. We say these sorts of things, you know. It ruins an awful lot of really good hymns as well when soul gets, it ruins them. I try and just sing it and mean it as it's intended. But if we want to actually know what Deuteronomy says, we have to let go of that idea of soul. You might want to pick it up again later on and say, well, actually, you know, later on, maybe those later Christians had it right. But for Deuteronomy, that's not what Deuteronomy is saying.
Can I just ask something? Obviously, if the Hebrews believed that the body and soul separation was an alien idea, would they have believed at death that the body should be preserved by burial as opposed to cremation? And
yeah.
Again,
cremation didn't really come in until kind of Greeks and Romans entered the scene. Whilst there's quite a lot of debate in the intertestamental period and beyond, burial was the norm. When you read about it, in the text, you'll read about burials. You'll read about caves being bought and bodies being put in them. You'll read about burials as the most common. I don't think that they would necessarily believe that God was incapable of resurrecting someone who'd been cremated. For example, those who are lost at sea were to be brought up. And as you can see here, there's this idea of even when you're dust, because, I mean, Adam was dust. You know, it's not beyond God whatsoever. But the practice was to bury. And so it's quite interesting how the Hebrew people thought of it. You may wish to think the same way, you may not. The point, however, for tonight is the fact that that then changes Deuteronomy 6 quite significantly. And it makes it a lot more intelligible, as far as I can see. I'd better. So, yes, Levav, emotions, thoughts, intent, nefesh, breath, blood, flesh, which I think is the physical and the non-physical part of who you are, as it were. And for me, it helps to think of hardware and software, and I appreciate that might not work for everybody. But, you know, there's the bit of the computer you can kick, and then there's the bit of the computer that's probably let you down. Yes. Yes. It's just the wrong way around, isn't it? Yeah. No. Now, all of that is enough to get on with, to be honest, but there's actually one more word that is integral to this, because it says, love the Lord your God with all of your all of your heart, love the Lord your God with all of your soul. I'm already uncomfortable with these two. Imagine how I'm going to go with this one. So, love the Lord your God with all of your strength. Now, to be fair, in English, strength does not necessarily mean physical strength. Or at least not just that, you know? Now, right now is not a very good time for me. Clearly, I'm stooped over, my back is sore. My physical strength is feeling threatened at the moment, I must confess. But normally, I feel I'm quite a strong person, you know, I'm feeling great. But I'll be entirely honest, although I think that I am stronger than my wife, it is only in that narrow band. She is stronger than me emotionally. She is stronger than me, probably spiritually. She's probably stronger than me in every which way you could possibly measure it and think of it. We have that in English. And it's the same in Hebrew. It is encompassing a wide variety of strength. It's not just meant to be love the Lord your God with some effort. It's everything. But because of this word is incredible. It goes beyond that. So it encompasses that idea and it's more. It's actually, to be fair, it means completely or to the nth degree. And I say that because it's like the most absolute extent of something. So the way that Cain, for example, hates Abel. He doesn't dislike him, he doesn't just hate him. He hates him to the nth degree. You know, the waters that cover the earth in the flood completely cover. It's not like they covered a bit. You know, they covered, you know, there was a bit of mild flooding. You know, they had to get the insurance out. You know, it was like, you know, absolute to the nth degree. The wealth of Abraham, the unsurpassed wisdom of Solomon, and the sin of Sodom are all said to be moed. It's a term that our idiom, I suppose, would be the nth degree or gienet laldi, if you're, you know, used to that type of idiom. You know, it's really, really, really like the most it could be imagined, as it were. And so, for example, in Genesis 1, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was meod tov. Not just good, but utterly, utterly good to the nth degree. We'd probably say perfect, to give it a kind of a shorthand. Utterly good. Yeah. So, with moed, because it's that nth degree, because it's the extreme, as it were, it also includes who you might be in the future. I love this idea. You see, if you love the Lord your God with all of your moed, it doesn't just mean all of your strength now. It doesn't just mean giving it to the nth degree now. It also includes everything that you could be in the future as well. You're not all that you could be. You could be more with God. And moed also encompasses your potential. And that potential with God is far greater. So it's saying, love the Lord your God here to the nth degree. So yeah, with all of your strength, the very last ounce of strength, as it were. And with everything that you could be. It's a beautiful word, actually. You know? It's actually quite a hopeful word, I find. I find this a quite an exciting word. I'm going to love him with everything I am, but I'm also going to love him with everything that I could be. I love that kind of idea. You can't translate that. I don't think. Strength is not bad. It encompasses quite a lot of it. So, how should we translate Deuteronomy 6, verse 5, with all of that? And I know I've talked too much. It's 8:55 now. I said I was kind of hoping that you guys would come up with an answer. Maybe, you know what, you might be able to come up with a better translation than me. Let's be honest. It's entirely possible. But let me just give you something to take away at the end of all of this. And I'll be happy to answer a lot of the questions that have been stoked up through the evening as well, as it were. But I'd probably go with this. Now, really love. Remember Ahab? That incredible love, the greatest love that you can have. Yahweh, your God of gods, with everything that makes you human, your levav, and with every living breath. So you know what, in there, I'm having to leave out quite a lot. There's bits in there that I recognize that aren't quite encompassed in that, but I think that that's the best that I can do. And do it utterly and completely. The idea of potential kind of falls out of the radar there. You know, that would be in the footnote. Should also be read, including your potential. But in order to try and give you a verse that can actually be used and doesn't just have every single thing in it, that's probably what I would go with. Really love Yahweh, God of gods, with everything that makes you human and with every living breath. That, to be fair, is the majority of uses of nefesh, is to talk about your breathing and your breath. And so I've kind of gone for that one in particular. And also in our own language, the way that, you know, loving with your final breath, with every breath, it has a sort of an idiomatic sense to it that I think kind of conveys a bit more. And do it utterly and completely. Which covers moed, covers strength of every description, but it's that completeness, that entirety with everything. Go for it. And so that's probably how I would go for it. That's probably how I would translate it. And my translation, bear in mind, having sat here for the last few hours, you'll recognize that my translation actually misses out quite a lot. And that's part of the problem when we try and shift from the Hebrew into the English. You know, what's the whole point of it all? What's the whole point of tonight? The key text, as it were, love the Lord your God. What kind of love? That incredible bond that is just the greatest love that you can possibly imagine. Love him. With what? Well, actually, love him with everything. Love him stubbornly. Love him with your thoughts. Love him with your ability to study. Love him with your ability to plan. Love with your ability to be imaginative. Love him with all of your emotions. When you're angry, you know what? Bring that to God. When you're filled with grief, bring that to God. Everything that you are. Love him with every living breath. You know? With this. You know, look after it. You know, make sure that you eat well, you sleep well, so that you are actually in good condition to go out there and be the person that you're supposed to be. Yeah, that's included. But, you know, love him with every breath that you have. Not every second breath, not every tenth breath, not just the breath that you may have when you're in this building, but with every breath that you have, love him. I love the fact it doesn't say obey him with every breath. Because you've shamad at the very beginning, you've already imbibed this. And if you love him, then you will go on to do the commandments. That's why this has to come first. Love. That unbreakable love. And you do that. You don't do it with half measures. You do it utterly and completely, to the nth degree. You know, I assure you, I love God 100%. The problem is, I need to do that 100% of the time. And sometimes I love myself more. And this text here is saying, actually, you know what you need to do? You need to love him utterly and completely. And just as a message of hope for us, God knows that we don't live up to this. This is the ideal. This is what we're supposed to be. And one of the great things with the Old Testament is it talks about the failure of the people of God, and it talks about a God who comes to the rescue. Not just to say, oh, I'm going to rescue you from him, I'm going to rescue you from her, I'm going to rescue you from yourself. And that's one of the most beautiful things, when we see that this is what we're called to be. And God, you know, I believe that when I see God face to face, and I'm it's going to be a disaster. I mean, here's the life I did lead compared to the one I should have led, you know, and I'm going to have to see him face to face. I actually believe that his smile will split glory. But I'll be honest, at that moment, I will wish that I had been more of this, more of the time. But I have a God who will save me from myself one day, and I will live that in fullness. Which I believe is why it's so important as our pivotal